All right, if you would, let's be turning back to the Old Testament book of Judges. How many of you like war movies? I really enjoy war movies, but I'm the only one in my family who does, and so I often have to watch them by myself. And sometimes I'll get an edited version to cut down on the language and the gore, but I like the epic battle scenes. I like watching the different strategies that are employed. I like the bravery and the sacrifice. And I often wonder, if I had to, could I do what they did? And I really like it when it's so well done that it keeps me on the edge of my seat and keeps my heart pounding throughout the movie. Well, last week, we looked at Gideon's call. We also looked at Gideon's first task to tear down his father's pagan altar in chapter 6. But this week, we're going to be looking at his first battle. And it's certainly not what we would consider to be conventional warfare. I would love to see the story of Gideon turned into a blockbuster movie with A-list actors and a $150 million budget. Oh, and that stays true to the Bible. Yeah, I'm not getting my hopes up. Okay, for those who weren't here last week, the book of Judges is often referred to as the Dark Ages of Israel's history. It was a period of religious and moral decline, national disunity, and foreign oppression. Immorality, idolatry, wars, both internal and external, were common. God had commanded the Israelites to be a holy and a righteous nation, but they had a really hard time with that. And in the book of Judges, we see this cycle that is repeated over and over. Peace, everything's going well. Apostasy, they become complacent and sinful, and they forget about God and fall away from Him. Oppression, God raised up another nation to thump them and to try to wake them up. Repentance, they realized that they had messed up and that they needed God, and so they turned back to Him and cried for help. Deliverance, well, God raised up a judge to save them, and then, well, they have a time of peace, which leads into apostasy, oppression, repentance, deliverance. Peace, apostasy, oppression, repentance, deliverance, over and over. As has been said, the only thing we learn from history is that we don't learn from history. Now, when we use the term judge, we're often thinking of someone who has got a gavel and in a courtroom and one of those robes and that kind of stuff. That is very different from the judges in this book. Now, they did do some governing from time to time, but we can see that they were primarily these military heroes and military leaders who were chosen to deliver Israel from their enemies. So what about Gideon? Well, he was probably not the man that any of us would have chosen to deliver Israel from the Midianites. We first read about him threshing wheat in a wine press, hiding from the Midianites. When the angel of the Lord came to him, he shared his skepticism about God. And then he gave the excuse that he was from the wrong tribe, he was from the wrong family, and he was too young. Well, then he wanted a sign. He wanted a sign that the angel really was speaking for God. Then he was too afraid to tear down his father's altar during the day, and so he did it at night. Then, after finally gathering an army, well, he wanted not one, but two signs from the fleece that God was really going to use him to deliver Israel. So the Bible portrays Gideon as this discouraged farm boy who was skeptical about God and skeptical about himself. But here's the wonderful thing. God doesn't just see us as we are, but as we can become. We learn from the Bible that God usually calls the lowly and not those who are already mighty. And we can see from the Bible that he chooses these unlikely, inadequate people over and over. Now, last week I asked the question, have you ever felt like Gideon? You know, God, he comes to us and he calls us to do something. And we're like, God, you've got the wrong person. No, he knows who he's got. I've heard it said that God uses flawed, fallible, failing people because if he didn't, he wouldn't have any people to use. Okay, we learn from chapter 6 in verses 33 through 35 that the army of the Midianites and some others who had joined them were camped in the valley of Jezreel. And that's in the northern part of Manasseh. And you may remember there are a number of very important battles in the Bible that were fought there. And the Spirit of the Lord, he came upon Gideon and he assembled an army from his own tribe and from some of the neighboring tribes. So, number one, we have got Gideon's men in verses 1 through 8. And I've asked Ken if you would go ahead and read for us again.
Judges 7, verse 1. Early in the morning, Jerubbaal, that is Gideon, and all his men camped at the spring of Herod. The camp of Midian was north of them in the valley near the hill of Moreh. The Lord said to Gideon, "You have too many men for me to deliver Midian into their hands, in order that Israel may not boast against me that her own strength has saved her. Announce now to the people, anyone who trembles with fear may turn back and leave Mount Gilead." So 22,000 men left, while 10,000 remained. But the Lord said to Gideon, "There are still too many men. Take them down to the water, and I will sift them for you there. If I say, 'This one shall go with you,' he shall go. But if I say, 'This one shall not go with you,' he shall not go." So Gideon took the men down to the water. There the Lord told him, "Separate those who lap the water with their tongues like a dog from those who kneel down to drink." 300 men lapped with their hands to their mouths. All the rest got down on their knees to drink. The Lord said to Gideon, "With the 300 men that lapped, I will save you and give you the Midianites into your hands. Let all the other men go, each to his own place." So Gideon sent the rest of the Israelites to their tents, but kept the 300, who took over the provisions and trumpets of the others. Now the camp of Midian lay below him in the valley.
Well, here is what the spring of Herod looks like today. And some have pointed out that Herod, ironically, means trembling. Or maybe it was named that after the incident. But as you can see, it's still a nice spring. Okay, the Israelites, they had only 32,000 men, which was, well, it was about 100,000 less than the Midianites. And in war, it's usually common sense to have as many as you can. We want to try to outnumber your enemy. That'll give you a better chance. But God said, the people who are with you are too many. And maybe Gideon was like, "I was actually about to say that they're too few." But you see, God knew what would happen. There have been plenty of battles in history where a smaller army has won. And so they would just come back from the battle saying, "Man, are we warriors or are we warriors?" Well, looking at the first test in verse 3, quite a few of them were apparently pleased with that announcement, and 22,000 of them went home. Now, keep in mind that we learn from chapter 8, verse 10, that there were about 135,000 soldiers in the Midianite camp, as well as having camels. Also, a lot of the Israelites, you remember, they've been up in the hills, they've been hiding in the caves, and you know, they're not trained military soldiers. And some people, well, they'll ask then, if they were so afraid, why did they come in the first place? Well, I suspect it was peer pressure. And it was the expectations on them. My father and my uncle and my brother, they've decided to go, and that cute girl over there is looking at me, and so she's looking in my direction. And so these guys got an out, and they took it. I wonder if Gideon, I wonder if he secretly wanted to do the same. He secretly wanted to go with them back home. Well, back in Deuteronomy chapter 20 and verse 8, before the conquest of Canaan, it says, "Then the officers shall speak further to the people and say, 'Who is the man that is afraid and faint-hearted? Let him depart and return to his house, so that he might not make his brother's hearts melt like his heart.'" As has been said, fear is contagious. And we've seen a lot of that in these last couple of years. And in general, if you surround yourself with people who struggle with fear, it will often rub off on you. So they were down to 10,000 soldiers. It was now 35 to 1. Each Israelite would have to kill 35 men. But God said the people are still too many. And so there was a second test. Well, the Hebrew in verses 5 and 6, it's a bit difficult, but it could be saying that they used their cupped hands like a dog's tongue to bring the water to their mouth. And it's been suggested that this test got rid of those who were not watchful and alert. See, if you're on all fours with your head down in the water, you can't see a thing that's going on around you, and you're temporarily incapacitated. Now, I don't know if that's the point, but it sounds plausible to me. I mean, you could even be scooping the water with one hand while your other hand was on your weapon. Now, I actually remember learning about Gideon in kindergarten when I was 5 years old. I was in a private Christian school, and my teacher, Mrs. Crawford, she was telling us a story, and she was having us act out different portions of it. Well, we got to this part, and she said that we were going to pretend to go to the water and drink, and she wanted to see how we would do it. She was conducting her own test. Well, I jumped to the pretend water, and I stuck my head right in. A bunch of the other kids did the same. But there were a few of them that pretended to scoop the water. Oh, I remember I was so upset when she told me that I could not fight in the battle because of the way I drank the water. I was actually holding back the tears. And so, well, okay, they were not tested by their strength or their stamina or their ability, their skill with a weapon, but by their courage and possibly alertness. And they were down to 300 men. That's 450 to 1. And God said, now we're good. Nobody would ever be able to say the Israelites did it on their own. And so he started with a little more than the population of the city of Rolla when S&T is in session, but he ended up with the population of the Rolla Church of Christ when everyone shows up. It's amazing to me that the 300 stayed with Gideon and didn't throw up their hands and decide to just take off. Well, you see, they trusted in God and in Gideon. Well, as you know, preachers, they often like to use the same letter when trying to make a point. And so here's one way that I've heard it put before. So the first test got rid of the cowards. The second test got rid of the compromisers. And what was left was the committed. Now, the point, of course, is that God doesn't need numbers. What he needs is committed people. I know that we sometimes get frustrated when people don't volunteer for something or that they keep backing out. But keep in mind that God can do great things with a small number of people. So you don't always need more people. Sometimes it's better to just have the right people. But I wonder what was going on in Gideon's mind while this is happening, the 32,000 down to 300. It could be that all of those feelings of inadequacy that we read about in chapter 6, that they were coming back again. And that brings us to the next section with the soldier's dream in verses 9 through 18.
During that night, the Lord said to Gideon, "Get up, go down against the camp, because I am going to give it into your hands. If you are afraid to attack, go down to the camp with your servant Perah and listen to what they are saying. Afterward, you will be encouraged to attack the camp." So he and Perah's servant went to the outpost of the camp. The Midianites, the Amalekites, and all the other eastern peoples had settled in the valley, thick as locusts. Their camels could no more be counted than the sand on the seashore. Gideon arrived just as a man was telling a friend his dream. "I had a dream," he was saying. "A round loaf of barley bread came to the Midianite camp. It struck the tent with such force that the tent overturned and collapsed." His friend responded, "This can be nothing other than the sword of Gideon, son of Joash, the Israelite. God has given the Midianites and the whole camp into his hands." When Gideon heard the dream and its interpretation, he worshiped God. He returned to the camp of Israel and called out, "Get up! The Lord has given the Midianites' camp into your hands. Dividing the 300 men into three companies, he placed trumpets and empty jars in the hands of all of them, with torches inside. "Watch me," he told them. "Follow my lead. When I get to the edge of the camp, do exactly as I do. When I and all who are with me blow our trumpets, then from all around the camp, blow yours and shout for the Lord and for Gideon."
God said, "If you are afraid," and sure enough, he went. He was indeed afraid. And God told him to take his servant. Maybe he would have been too timid to go alone. And so in the dark, they snuck down to the edge of the Midianite camp and listened. And besides the dream and what was said, I'm sure it was encouraging to hear his name being said out loud like that. And on top of that, I'm sure it was discouraging to any of the enemy soldiers who could hear them talking. Now, barley was considered an inferior grain to wheat, and so this is poor man's bread. The Midianites had certainly made the Israelites poor from all of their raids. So apparently, the barley loaf, it represented the agricultural Israelites and maybe their small size, and the tent represented the nomadic Midianites. Now, obviously, a loaf of bread is not normally going to knock down and flatten a tent. I've heard of some people's fruitcake that might, but I digress. Now, some people, they picture a ginormous world record kind of loaf barreling down the hill, but it doesn't say that. The point, of course, is that God can use what seems insignificant to us, like 300 men against a huge army. Well, the dream and its interpretation, it was either given by God or God simply knew what was going to be said, and he knew that it would encourage Gideon to hear it. And so Gideon, he silently knelt down and worshiped God right there. Have you ever had something immediately bring you to your knees in worship and thanks to God? Well, like Gideon, we need to let God encourage us, and then we need to get back to what we need to be doing. It may be something that you read in your personal Bible study. It may be something that's said in a sermon or a Bible class. It may be something that was said to you by a fellow Christian. It may be after a good time of prayer. It may even be after just spending some time out in God's creation. But make sure that you get your encouragement from God. Now, people turn to all kinds of things to try to get encouragement, sometimes even negative or sinful things. Okay, only 300 men, and here are their weapons. Trumpets from shofar, speaking of a ram's horn, pitchers, and torches. It's not just by our standards today that these would be considered ridiculous weapons for battle, all right? They would have thought so as well. It would be hard to imagine a greater test of faith, I think. Well, we see that he divided them into three companies, probably so they'd be more spread out and so they could surround the Midianites better. And so number three, we've got the Midianites' defeat in verses 19 through 23.
Verse 19, Gideon and the 100 men with him reached the edge of the camp at the beginning of the middle watch, just after they had changed the guard. They blew their trumpets and broke the jars that were in their hands. The three companies blew the trumpets and smashed the jars, grasping the torches in their left hands and holding in their right hands. The trumpets they were to blow, they shouted, "A sword for the Lord and for Gideon." While each man held his position around the camp, all the Midianites ran, crying out as they fled. When the 300 trumpets sounded, the Lord caused the men throughout the camp to turn on each other with their swords. The army fled to Beth Shittah toward Zerera, as far as the border of Abel-Meholah near Tabith. Israelites from Naphtali, Asher, and all Manasseh were called out, and they pursued the Midianites.
Despite it probably sounding crazy to most of them, taking the number down to 300 men and not using swords, well, it worked. Now, the ancient Israelites, they divided the night into three watches. And so this would have been after they had gone to sleep. Have you ever been woken up in the middle of the night by a loud noise. And I am sure the noise of this would have been tremendous, echoing through the valley. And their torches, which appeared all of a sudden, gave the impression of being surrounded by just a massive army. And normally, only a small number of men in an army carried trumpets, and maybe the same was true of the torches. And so I think that it appeared as if each of the 300 was at the head of a battalion of soldiers. They were startled, they were confused, they thought the Israelites were pouring into their camp. And so in the darkness, they drew their swords and they just started slashing. They started attacking each other, thinking they were attacking the Israelites. I'm reminded of the time when I jumped on my dresser in the middle of the night because I thought it was a burglar. Man, that hurt. Anyway, the confused Midianite army pretty much destroyed itself. And the Israelites then pursued the ones who escaped. Now, here's something to think about. God could have easily just had all of them fall over dead, or he could have had the earth open up and swallow them, or he could have sent Godzilla to take care of them or something like that. But instead, Gideon and his men still had to do the work. They still had to do their part. You see, God works with us and through us, and partly, I think, because he's trying to teach us something, and he's trying to mature us. Well, after this, the story, it gets a bit messy with a number of ups and downs, and that's because it's based on real life and not a fairy tale. But in chapter 8, in verse 28, it says, Midian was subdued before the sons of Israel, and they did not lift up their heads anymore, and the land was undisturbed for 40 years in the days of Gideon. It is amazing what God did with a timid farm boy. And yes, Gideon made some mistakes, but he grew into a really good leader. The transformation of Gideon is pretty remarkable. Again, he ended up in Hebrews chapter 11. Well, there was one point when they wanted to make him king, and they wanted to make his family into a dynasty. But he said, I will not rule over you, nor shall my son rule over you. The Lord shall rule over you. In chapter 8, verse 23. God had only raised him up to be a judge, not a king. Gideon is a good example of someone who is not power hungry. He just wanted to do the job that God had given him. Like Gideon, refuse power and wealth if it is not what God wants for you. How many people will do whatever it takes? They'll even sell their soul for just a little bit of power and wealth. We need to be willing to turn things down, no matter how desirable they may sound, if they are contrary to what God has said and what he wants for us. Okay, there are four main lessons that I think we need to get from this chapter and that I'd like for us to remember. Number one, looking at verse 2, we need to make sure to give God the credit. My own power has delivered me. How do you like it when someone steals the credit from you? Now, I've heard it said like this. We sing that song, to God be the glory, great things he has done, while we're actually thinking, to God be part of the glory, great things we have done, or worse, and we leave him out altogether. We need to quit taking the credit that belongs to God. Our pride often wants to take as much credit as we can, earned or not. Okay, number two, sometimes God's instructions don't make sense, at least at the time. God likes to use things that go against our limited human understanding and logic. See, choosing a timid farm boy to save Israel, going from 32,000 to 300, the crazy dream with a loaf of bread, using trumpets and pitchers and torches. There is not much of that that made sense at the time. Think of Noah building an ark. Think of the blood on the doorposts. Think of the Israelites having to look at the bronze serpent. Think of striking or talking to a rock for water. Think of marching around Jericho. Think of Naaman dipping seven times in the Jordan and so forth. And there are plenty of instructions in the New Testament that go against what our culture is telling us. And they go against what we would like to do or what makes sense to us. And the question is, during those times when God's instructions don't make sense, are we going to obey or disobey? It's really easy to obey when it's something that we agree with, something that we understand. But Proverbs 3:5 says to trust in the Lord with all your heart and do not lean on your own understanding. A failure to understand does not give us a pass. A failure to understand does not justify a failure to obey. If we want the victory, we need to trust and obey. Number three, don't look at the size of the problem, look at the size of God. 300 against 135,000. It seems that sometimes God likes to have the odds stacked against us. Remember David and Goliath. Remember Elijah against the 300 prophets of Baal. Remember Jesus telling his disciples in the beginning to go into all of the world and make disciples of all the nations. As Jonathan said in 1 Samuel 14:6, "Come, let us cross over to the garrison of these uncircumcised. Perhaps the Lord will work for us, for the Lord is not restrained to save by many or by few." Now, in that case, it was just the two of them. And going uphill with a great disadvantage, they killed 20 soldiers and really disheartened the enemy. It's very easy for us to look at a situation and to say, the enemy is too big. It's not. When you have God on your side. Romans 8:31, if God is for us, who can be against us? 1 John 4:4, greater is he who is in you than he who is in the world. It's not the size of the problem, it's the size of God. And number four, similar to the last point, you are never too small or insignificant to be used by God. If God can use someone like Gideon, a discouraged farm boy. And if he can use a little army of 300 to defeat an army of 135,000, God can use you, and he can use me, and he can use this congregation. Now again, see, they're not all here today, but how many people do we have in this congregation? 300. I like the way Paul put it in 1 Corinthians chapter 1, verses 26 to 29. For consider your calling, brethren, that there were not many wise according to the flesh, not many mighty, not many noble, but God has chosen the foolish things of the world to shame the wise, and God has chosen the weak things of the world to shame the things which are strong, and the base things of the world and the despised God has chosen, the things that are not, so that he may nullify the things that are, so that no man may boast before God. That's the way he does things. And so maybe now you understand a little more why Gideon is found in the Heroes of Faith chapter in Hebrews 11:32. And I believe if we will let him, God can use us. And he can do great things through us as well.